This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood stops by the GLT studios to talk about transportation, Congress, and the presidential race.
Donald Trump will only be able to get a very, very small group of people in America to support him, which means he won't be elected president.
The ex-Obama cabinet member is backing Jeb Bush. He'll explain why and why a gas tax increase is the best way to fund transit. The transformation of downtown Normal into uptown is but a part of the town's explosive growth the past couple of decades. Charlie Schlenker talks with someone who helped work Normal's recent growth plan. And you'll hear from the man whose work brought us the hilarious online meme of awkward family photos. Some of the best are on display in Peoria. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Thursday, October 8th, 2015. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT. With additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group, more information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Ray LaHood was President Barack Obama's first transportation secretary. He assumed the role after serving in Congress for several years, representing much of central Illinois, including parts of McLean County, as a Republican. Next month, his book, Seeking Bipartisanship, My Life in Politics, is being released. Yesterday, he delivered an address to the Illinois chapter of the American Planning Association State Conference in Normal, and he stopped by the GLT studios. Ray LaHood, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Let's talk first about transportation. Congress has not been able to come to a meeting of the minds on long-term transit funding. As a former member of Congress and ex-transportation secretary, you have a unique perspective on this situation. What is the major issue? What's the holdup?
The holdup is not what we need to do in America. The holdup is finding the money to do it. In the past, Congress has been able to use the Highway Trust Fund, which is now broke, by the way. There just is a very limited amount of money in that fund, to fund six-year bills. When I was in Congress, I served on the Transportation Committee, and we passed 2 6-year bills during the time that I sat on the committee. And we did it in a way that was very bipartisan, and we took care of America's needs, and we continued to build roads. And over the last 50 years, America built the interstate system using the Highway Trust Fund, built lots of other infrastructure. And the crisis in America is the funding. How do we pay for it? And what I'm recommending and what I've been talking about is raising the gas tax, which is the money that goes into the Highway Trust Fund. And we need to probably raise it about 10 cents a gallon, index it, and then we'd have the resources to really begin to make progress in America. We're falling way, way behind.
And those who argue against raising the gas tax, not necessarily because they're anti-transportation, is because there's so much alternative transportation fuel uses out there that there's actually less gas being used. So is that really the best way to do that when you consider that particular scenario?
The big pot of money that built America, the big pot of money that built the interstate system, built the magnificent structures that are our bridges and other infrastructure, was the Highway Trust Fund. And that pot of money, that gas tax, has not been raised for 20 years. 1993 was the last time it was raised. Even during a very conservative administration of Ronald Reagan, they raised the gas tax. Even during the time of Republican George Herbert Walker Bush, they raised the gas tax. President Clinton persuaded Congress to raise the gas tax. So it seems as though every 10 to 20 years we raise the gas tax because it's depleted. That's what we need to do today. If we're going to get back to being number one, if we're going to get back to fixing all of these roads that are falling apart, we've had some very brutal winters all across America. And it's created an America that's one big pothole right now.
It sounds like what we have really is a deeper issue than just raising the gas tax. It's a Congress that doesn't want to raise any taxes at all, period. In fact, has trouble doing anything at all, period.
Yeah, Congress is stalemated right now. There's no question about it. Congress should be dealing with immigration reform, tax reform, transportation, infrastructure issues. They should be dealing with budget issues, which they're not. And all of these issues are being kicked down the road because Congress can't really get their act together.
And I want to pursue that a little bit with you in just a moment, but I'm going to get right back to the gas tax and the, and funding transit for just a moment. There are some innovative approaches to funding transit. One of them deals with the GPS that would control the miles driven in a particular area. What do you think about that idea?
I think all of these issues should be on the table. I think tolling is a way to raise money. I think vehicle miles traveled is a way to raise money. You'd have to pass legislation to do it. Tolling is already being used by many states, including our own state of Illinois. I think public-private partnerships. Well, we were at the Department of Transportation. We funded a lot of public-private partnerships to fund big projects. But there simply is not enough money in any of those programs to make up for the big pot of money that we need right now in order to rebuild America.
You presided over the impeachment proceedings of President Clinton when you were in Congress back in the late 90s, and you were chosen for this duty because of your work with civility in Congress and trying to reach consensus among party lines. Now, think about that situation and what we have today. What are the differences and the similarities?
I think the differences today are that you have 40 to 50 members of the U.S. House and a handful in the Senate, maybe five or six, who call themselves Tea Party members, were elected under the banner of Tea Party to come to Washington and vote no on everything. They don't believe in government, and they really don't believe in any kind of programs that would move the country forward. And so they're the group of people that shut down the government last year, that vote no on everything, that stand in the way of really making progress in the Congress.
They would argue, I guess, that they were elected by people in their district to do just that. The people knew who they were getting, what they were getting when they voted them in. So is this really a problem with Congress? Is this a matter of the entire population, the voting public of the United States?
Congress obviously has been around for 230-plus years. And during that time, Congress has solved big problems, big issues. I think of Senator Everett Dirksen, who came from an all-white community, Pekin, Illinois, rose to become Senate Minority Leader and worked with a Democratic president to pass civil rights legislation 50 years ago. And we've just celebrated that significant legislation that was passed 50 years ago. The idea that Congress can't solve big problems is more born out of this idea that there are enough people that can stop progress, and that's not what Congress is about. Congress is about solving problems. Congress is about moving America forward. Congress is about keeping up with the issues of the day that need to be really looked at, debated, and voted on.
Even though you served under a Democratic administration, you are a lifelong Republican. What do you think of people like Donald Trump who are on the scene today? Definitely not heading in the direction that we've discussed here.
Yeah. Well, look, Donald Trump is not going to be elected president. He just simply can't be because he's not going to be able to attract more than Republican votes. He certainly won't be able to attract Democrats, independents, and maybe some other voters because he's alienated many different groups in America. And in order to get elected president, you have to get more than just your own party's votes. The reason that Romney lost was because he was only able to get Republican voters to support him. Donald Trump will only be able to get a very, very small group of people in America to support him, which means he won't be elected president.
What is he doing, though, to the whole fabric of civility in this country?
Well, look, the statements that he's made have certainly been bigoted. They've been prejudice against certain groups. They've offended many different people in America, including women, including African Americans, including Hispanics. And the idea that he promotes that everybody's stupid in Washington, that nobody knows what they're doing in Washington, he's an outlier. He just, it's simply not true. And in the end, the American people are not going to buy this. He's been able to get 25, 26, 27% of the people in polls to support him. But when it gets down to voting, I think the American people are pretty smart about these things. They want leaders who are going to solve problems. They want leaders who are going to move the country forward. They want leaders that will lead in the international community. I think Donald Trump lacks all of that ability.
So who is Ray LaHood supporting for president?
I like Jeb Bush. I think Governor Bush did a great job as governor in Florida. And I think he really represents the kind of leadership. He knows the job, having watched his father and his brother serve in that position. He knows the challenges. He's put out a lot of good issue papers in terms of solving problems, and I think he would be attractive to the American people.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern, and we're visiting with Ray LaHood, President Barack Obama's first transportation secretary and longtime member of Congress from Peoria and Central Illinois. How has your relationship with Republican leaders in the United States changed because you served in an Obama Democratic administration?
You know, transportation, which I served as secretary of, has always been a bipartisan organization. Not much conflict, not much controversy. I've maintained a very good relationship with leadership, both on the Republican and Democratic side, with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, with governors, both Republican and Democratic governors, with mayors who are Republican or Democratic. And so all across America, our reputation among elected officials of both parties has been very high.
What would you consider as your major accomplishment, both as a representative in Congress and as transportation secretary?
I think in Congress, what we did is set a very high bar for bipartisanship. I've just written a book, which will be out here in another month, and the title of it is Bipartisanship. And I think my ability to reach across the aisle to maintain the kind of relationships in both parties with representatives from both parties, I think carried me pretty far into Congress. And then serving as Secretary of Transportation in President Obama's administration, I think our number one legacy will be safety. The thing that I say most often is that people get up every day in America. They get in a car, on a bus, on a train, on an airplane, and the thing they don't think about is safety. That's what we thought about for 4.5 years at the Department of Transportation, making transportation safe. The other thing that I think we'll be remembered for is the issue of distracted driving. Before we came into the department, no one was talking about it. Only 18 states had passed laws, and now almost all 50 states have passed laws against distracted driving, using your cell phone while you're driving or texting and driving, and I think we've saved a lot of injury and a lot of lives focusing on safety.
Is there too much focus on accommodating single-occupancy vehicle travel these days? What, in conjunction with that, what do you think is the future of multimodal transportation?
We put a lot of emphasis on multimodal transportation. What people in the cities want, particularly the bigger cities, Chicago, L.A., Atlanta, Philly, Washington, D.C., they want many forms of transportation. People ordinarily that live in those cities, particularly younger people, are attracted there because they don't have to own a car, that they can be involved in a bike share program, there are opportunities for walking and biking. There are opportunities for mass transit, whether it be buses, trains, light rail. We put a lot of emphasis on that, and we did it because that's what the mayors wanted. They knew that in order to attract young, smart people to their communities, they had to offer the kind of transportation that would allow for these people, if they didn't want to own an automobile and pay the insurance and all of the headaches that go with it of driving around in congestion, that's what a lot of these communities in America are putting their emphasis on now.
Ray LaHood, we appreciate your time today. Ray LaHood was President Barack Obama's first transportation secretary and a longtime representative in Congress serving Peoria in the 18th District. Again, thanks for stopping
by. Thank you very much.
Next month, Ray LaHood's book, Seeking Bipartisanship, My Life in Politics, is being released. He spoke in Normal yesterday to the Illinois chapter of the American Planning Association State Conference. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Ahead, it's another of our normal 150 interviews as part of the town's sesquicentennial observation. Charlie Schlenker sits down with Public Works Director Wayne Aldrich, who had a hand in much of Normal's recent growth. That interview coming up during Sound Ideas. The perfectly imperfect moments of family life are the focus of a new exhibition at the Peoria Riverfront Museum. A popular website has moved from the internet and into the gallery to provide a place for all of us to celebrate the awkward family photo. WGLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
Admit it. You've got them tucked away somewhere secret, where no one can see the past sins of ghastly hairdos or dubious sartorial choices. Or maybe they're on your wall, proudly displaying every bit of their awkward glory. No matter where they are, there's no avoiding the inevitability of awkward family photos. And now they're coming out of the bottom drawers and off the walls and going up at the Peoria Riverfront Museum, adorned, by the way, by equally awkward frames. Curator Kristen McKenzie says the show brings a lot of humor to the museum and helps visitors see the museum in a different way.
We get accused sometimes of being elitist. You know, we have fine art on view. People still sometimes think you need to know certain things, you need to have a certain kind of education to go to a museum. And we want them to know that the museum is for everyone. And the museum is a place to learn. It's a place to see new things. It's a place to have conversations. And this exhibit certainly is engendering conversations between family members who come together.
Have you been eavesdropping on any of those?
I did it when it first came, and it was fun. We had a lot of, it's especially fun when you get an intergenerational family, even three generations, talking, because it does bring up memories about, I remember when I wore my hair that way, or, oh, I can't believe, or, you know, that kind of thing. And it's, you know, people can relate to it.
Awkward family photos date back as far as photography goes, but the awkward family photo phenomenon began in 2006 when writer Mike Bender discovered his mother had put on the wall an awkward photo from his teen years. Rather than roll his eyes and turn away, Bender was inspired.
I went out to lunch with my writing partner at the time, and we started to talk about it, and he said, "My house is full of those types of photos. This is Doug Chernak." And we realized, well, if we have them, then everybody must have them. And so could we create a website where, you know, people would feel comfortable sharing their uncomfortable family photos? That was really the inception, and that was kind of our jumping off point. And we didn't know if people would do it, but we started with just our own photos and photos from friends and family, and that's how we launched.
Were you at all surprised that so many people actually wanted to send you their awkward family photos?
We weren't surprised at the response, for sure, because we really didn't know what would happen. We had a gut instinct that there was something universal here, that there was something that everybody could relate to, so, you know, we had a thesis that people would respond, but we didn't know in what fashion they would. So yeah, we were definitely surprised by the response. Also, it confirmed what we thought, which is that everybody has one, and everybody understands sort of the concept of awkwardness with their families. Everyone's experienced an awkward moment with their families, whatever it might be, and it's it's another side of family that we don't always talk about, but certainly one that exists.
What qualifies a photo as awkward?
I think to a certain degree, awkwardness is in the eye of the beholders. Our definition is that an awkward photo is anything that makes the person looking at it uncomfortable or creates some sort of discomfort in some way. That can come from a pose. That can come from something happening in the background of the photo. That could come from the dynamic of that family coming through in the photo, meaning maybe brother and sister are in the middle of a fight, mom and dad are upset with each other. There's some tension in the photo. That can create awkwardness. It could be what the people are wearing, you know. It could be just the style of that time looking back is awkward. There's a ton of factors, but the idea that it's anything that creates some sort of discomfort in the viewer, and we look at it as a good discomfort, that photo could be considered awkward.
From the viewer's perspective, when people are looking at these awkward family photos, are they looking at them and judging, or are they relating to what they're seeing?
I don't think they're judging. I mean, honestly, the website wouldn't exist 7 years later if this was a website built on judgment, because what makes people submit and continue to submit their photos is this idea of there's a self-deprecation element to it, right, where someone's standing in their photo and saying, hey, check out my family. You know, you think your family's awkward? Check out my family. I think that's the spirit of the website, this idea that, you know, we're going to send in our photo and there's going to be something almost cathartic about it, about sharing this with the world and saying, you know, here I'm declaring that my family's awkward too and we're all in this together. I think it's a laughing with and not a laughing at. That's the way that, you know, the majority of our community has reacted. And I think the exhibition itself is really about walking around and seeing your own family in these photos.
To the left of me, jokers to the right, here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
This exhibition shows it's not just families who are inept photographers. Riverfront Museum curator Kristen McKenzie notes that even professional photos can be awkward if the photographer doesn't notice every detail through the lens.
Here we have a beautiful bride. They've posed her in front of a window, so there's a green background.
It's beautiful,
but there's a porta potty outside, and her nose is now right on top of it. So, you know, cute title, Fresh Air. Yeah, she's sniffing the porta potty, it looks like.
I have to look at that and think, was this the days before photoshopping where they could have just got rid of that?
Exactly. And some a lot of these are. There's a whole range of time period here.
Is it possible that these aren't so much awkward as they are endearing?
Oh, absolutely. Some of them are very endearing. And I'm sure that for some of the families that there's special moments, too, in their lives that they remember very fondly. And some of them are just awkward because of the time period. You know, the hairstyles were
odd. The 70s, that was a really awkward decade.
I mean, everybody, this whole white family with afros.
And braces. And those leisure suits.
Uh-huh, yeah. So it's just, you know, it wasn't awkward at the time, but it's fun now.
Making the leap from website to museum gallery seemed like the next logical step for Binder's awkward family photo collection. He says by putting them in a gallery, they can be shared in a family-like way.
First thing is, I think when you're looking at these photos on the internet, there's something disposable about photos on the internet. You kind of, you know, especially if you're on your phone, you're flipping through them, you know, with your thumb. If you're on, you know, a computer, you're just looking through things very quickly and you're getting kind of a quick soundbite of what these photos represent. When you're looking at them in the exhibition, there's something about seeing them all hung together. They're kind of hung salon style, so it's like you're seeing the collage of photos all together, and they're grouped in different categories, mom and dad, vacation, wedding. There's something kind of powerful about seeing them all grouped together that I think is more, that resonates more than just seeing it on a computer, on a phone as a one-off photo. The grouping of them is what makes the show more relatable and makes more of a statement about family as a whole. That's why we wanted to do the exhibition. We thought there's something interesting here. There's something really different about viewing these photos up close, being able to walk up to them and spend some time with them as opposed to just showing somebody, you know, hey, look on my phone, look at this photo.
Mike, do you feel like now you're firmly in the realm of pop art?
I think that we're crazy enough to consider this stuff art. You know, art is certainly open to interpretation, and so are these photos. There's this real statement that's being made about family. And some are more humorous than others. Some are more thoughtful than others. we are making it, you know, sort of like pulling the curtain back on another side of family that might not be talked about. Certainly in our own homes, we don't show these photos, right? Because we want the photo of the family smiling and looking perfect over the mantle. We don't want the photo of mom and dad looking upset at each other over the mantle, because we want to project the perfect sort of like version of our own family. There is something to that with this exhibition, that we're showing that other side, the idea that family is imperfect and that we're all in that together. Some of these photos have become iconic, especially online. It's amazing how passed around some of these photos have become. So I do think they become pop art.
That's Mike Bender, founder of Awkward Family Photos, along with Kristen McKenzie, curator from the Peoria Riverfront Museum. The exhibition of Awkward Family Photos is up through November 15th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
If on the outside chance you have no awkward family photos of your own, the Riverfront Museum is giving visitors an opportunity to create one. There's a giant frame and some props in the lobby so visitors can pose for their own meme-worthy awkward photo. There's a gallery of some of the awkward family photos you can see right now at WGLT.org. My personal favorite is number 6, Goth Girl at the Beach. Check it out. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall. Hold a throne.
Wait, Don't Tell Me is more than a fun look at the week's news. We also provide you with the latest developments in medicine and beer.
And Bud does sound like the noise that people tend to make when they're having a heart attack.
Yeah,
but.
Wait, the news quiz from NPR. It might just save your life. Listen for Wait, Don't Tell Me, Saturday morning at 9 on GLT, News and Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Quiet, unsexy policy priorities can shape a city. In GLT's final interview, focusing on the Normal 150 celebration, we unravel some of the choices made in recent decades that are shaping the town's present and future. Charlie Schlenker talks with town's public works director, Wayne Aldrich, who says the 1-2% annual population growth the town experienced posed challenges and presented some opportunities.
It changed a lot of the policy making of the town. The council, with all the new subdivisions and new growth, had to adopt certain policies to deal with that growth. And I think some of the decisions, right or wrong, that were made during this period have and will affect future policy making by the town council.
For instance?
I think and partially due to the Uptown plan when it originated in 1999 with the emphasis towards sustainability and new urbanism. I think the council, rather than sprawling growth like we saw during a lot of this period, the council will want denser development potentially, different types of thoughts regarding road systems. Before we just said build a four-lane road, I think at this time we're going to look at that a little bit closer and say, what other transportation uses will we want on that road? Bike lanes or sidewalks, and do you build a four-lane road even? Do you build a narrower street?
Was the town really prepared for the growth that happened?
That's hard to say. I mean, as far as the codes and things, yes, I would say. But it all happened so fast and in a major way. I think a lot of tough decisions were made by the council because there was a land sale for example, an agricultural property was sold. And it's like, per the code and per other mechanisms, how do you not approve a new subdivision, for example?
Did the town recoup its costs of development?
That's hard to say. We've tried to do models during the period to determine how much extra cost is spent by the town in providing additional services as opposed to how much revenue comes in. And we never did get an accurate model for that type of thing.
In the 80s and 90s, you've mentioned 1% to 2% per year, but that's a slow creeping aggregate. Can you give a sense of the total scope of it from the beginning to the end so listeners can get an appreciation at the huge change?
During this period, yeah. I think, you know, one of the main ones is Ironwood went in during the early period of this. All the area in the northeast part of Normal, like Rab Road, was extended in those areas, and Towanda Avenue, those subdivisions near those roads, Pinehurst during the earlier periods, and then even some development out west. Tartland College developed during this period out in Normal.
It brings us to an interesting point. Sometimes public development spurs private development.
Yes, and one of the bigger instances of that during this period was what we call the northeast development, spurred on primarily by Unit 5 having the need to build a couple new schools. And so they needed a new high school and a new grade school and bought property in Northeast Normal, what is now Normal Community and Grove Elementary. So that happened, I think, about 15 years ago. When they bought the property, there was no infrastructure to provide for these schools. And so they made a request to the Normal Town Council to provide this necessary infrastructure. A lot of people don't realize how big of a project that was from the engineering standpoint and really from the policymaking standpoint. The council decided to support this Unit 5 decision. We, on the engineering side, began designing roads and sewers to support the schools, which resulted in a very large sanitary sewer system, a new water main system, and roads like Airport Road was built, and portions of Rab Road to support that development. So again, there was a decision by a public agency that will lead to additional growth. And out there, it led to Eagles Landing, the Vineyards, Trails at Sunset, Mercy Creek ultimately. So a lot of development happened around that area because of this decision.
And is still happening and will happen.
Yes.
And yet it's that kind of suburban style growth is now somewhat at odds with the town emphasis on sustainability and compactness.
That's very possible that it is, and that may have affected some of the policy-making decisions related to uptown and some of the newer growth patterns. This newer thought about growth, I think, will be reflected in some of the upcoming policies by the council. It's also being adopted by other agencies like the Federal Highway Administration related to how you develop transportation infrastructure.
For instance?
The big push by the Federal Highways is what they call the Complete Streets Program. That really means not just think about moving vehicles, but moving people. And you might want to try to get more into that small piece of public right-of-way there. You know, more sidewalks, more bike lanes, and not disregard cars, but they're just another transportation mode. And so this is all policy that's being adopted by several communities, and I think that may be on the list for Normal, too, to adopt a complete streets program.
We've heard a lot over the years about transportation sustainability. How is residential housing going to take on the tinge of sustainability as planners go forward in the town?
I think, well, we're just starting the new Normal comprehensive plan, and so I think you'll see some of that discussed in the comprehensive plan for the future. But there are things like how we deal with stormwater in subdivisions, providing recreational facilities like in creek beds and detentions that still promote recreation but also are sustainable in the sense that they promote water quality. And I think some of the thoughts about neighborhood design will change to help promote healthy lifestyles, biking, walking, things like that. So both Bloomington and Normal have adopted bike and ped plans, and so trying to implement some of those plans. And so I think that's a very sustainable thing to do.
With the traditional suburban ranch-style or bi-level house model, one of the big features is the garage, as opposed to century-old houses where the big feature is the front porch.
Right.
How are we going to see sustainability modeled in housing design?
I think that'll take some time. We're thinking in that direction anyway. I think the age of the car is still going to be around for a while longer, but I think, again, ways to promote neighborhood, a big thing there, the first thing you do is sidewalks, ample sidewalks so people can walk and visit their neighbors. And I think there's still going to be porches, hopefully, on the new designs. I'm not sure the garage goes away anytime soon, but there may be, in the comprehensive plan, easy ways to get to places, like if you're in your neighborhood, is there a neighborhood center where you can easily go to a restaurant or pick up groceries, things like that. Better access to these areas, commercial activity centers, recreational areas, where you don't always have to get in your car. So trying to take the emphasis off the car, put it more on bikes and pedestrian activities and easier ways to get places.
You mentioned the service extension to the Northeast Quadrant, but also the renewal of city underground service infrastructure in Uptown is perhaps the biggest part of Uptown investment.
Right.
What other service infrastructure kinds of big, huge projects will the town need to pay attention to in the next couple decades?
We're already talking about fire stations, you know, reorganizing how we think about those to provide adequate service to the residents with fire stations. So we're thinking about that. And just proximity, and even in like public works, how many roads we build, how wide they are, we need to think about those things because the long-term maintenance of these facilities is very important and costly, frankly. So there's probably going to be more thought to that.
Is there a similar deterioration as to what was found in Uptown of water and sewer infrastructure in areas south of Uptown, close to the border, or in the northwest part of Normal?
There is. There's deterioration for different reasons in different systems. Like in our water systems and our sewer systems, we have corrosive soils and other issues that may lead to early deterioration of a system that we have to look at. And we still have very old sewer systems in particular, and I think we're upgrading our water system quite a bit in recent years. But on the sewer system side, there's going to have to be some investment in the sewer system to keep it up to date and repaired, such as we did in Uptown. I mean, basically Uptown, we replaced all the underground infrastructure. Again, that was a big component of that project, but we do have needs throughout the town. In the sewer system, we have pump stations now. One of the bigger ones was part of the Northeast development, a big pump station out there. And so when you have systems like that, it's much more complex in maintaining these different systems. So those are an ongoing need to make sure they're maintained in the future.
All these subdivisions, all the shift in emphasis of how infrastructure looks and affects movements and culture in the cities, has all this changed the identity of Normal?
I think the identity of Normal has changed in a big way because of the Uptown plan. And a couple things the council did early in the Uptown plan was adopt the LEED standards, the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design standards for development in the business district of Uptown. And they were the first in the nation to adopt a LEED standard in their code to require a LEED certified building for under 7,500 square foot of footprint. So the first in the nation. And so ever since that time, the council really has supported sustainability in designs and really become nationally known for a community of this size promoting these kinds of initiatives. So I think that's changed the identity of Normal. And I think the other big thing was the Uptown plan, and not just the plan, but that most of the plan, the original plan, got built. And I think that's an exceptional mark for the town, and we're well known for being able to implement that scale of a plan, again, for this size of a community.
If you think about the scope of a lot of these projects, they're huge, and they require a lot of political will to get done. It would be far easier to imagine, in some sense, a town without these things than with them. How did it happen?
You said it, Charlie, political will. I think that's a big part of it. The council from the very first, to me, was steadfast on the implementation of the Uptown plan. So they took some heat and they had a lot of tough decisions. But from my perspective, the council always kind of held fast and moved forward with the Uptown plan through various changes in the council membership. Even I think their direction has always been move forward. I was even surprised at the beginning that they adopted the scale of a plan as they did. We replaced everything, including all the underground infrastructure and many of the buildings. So I think to do something like that involved a lot of political will. I think there's also great leadership on the staff. So I think administration provided great leadership and support for the staff. On the staff level, I think a competent staff and a passionate staff is a big part of why that particular development was a success.
Wayne Aldrich has worn various hats over the years, including the titles of Uptown Development Director and City Engineer. He's had his fingerprints on a lot of the growth and development that's happened in the town in the last 20 years. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Charlie. My pleasure.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
A panel discussion on the development of Normal will be held Sunday at 2. It's on the fourth floor of Uptown Station. To hear other Normal 150 interviews, just check out WGLT.org. There's a Sound Ideas tab at the top of the page. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Habitat for Humanity of McLean County has done a lot of hard work in the community. Over the last 30 years, the nonprofit has been providing the pride of home ownership for those who might otherwise never be able to afford a home. WGLT's Jim Brown goes into downtown Bloomington now to find out more about the organization and its future.
Inside the Habitat for Humanity of McLean County office in downtown Bloomington's historic Brown Building, we found Executive Director Stan Giesen and Development Director Sarah Franzen. Giesen took the reins of the organization about a year ago, but he says he still recalls his first involvement with Habitat.
I can tie my involvement back to a very specific event in Bloomington history. I went to the first Not in Our Town rally that marched from the Bloomington Courthouse to Mount Pisgah Church. There was a sign-up table at that event to go to Mississippi to rebuild a church that had been burned near Meridian. I went on that trip and helped to build the church, and I realized I really don't have to go that far to do some good, and our community has some needs, and that's when I became involved with Habitat. That was nearly 20 years ago.
Wondering whether it was something like that, maybe the spirituality of Habitat for Humanity that resonated with you, the communal nature of home building effort, you know, kind of like an old barn building. And then, of course, there's the opportunity to just get dirty and enjoy some sunshine. What is it that you enjoy most about working on a home, Stan?
Well, Jim, it's probably all of the above. I personally feel most connected to God when I am involved in service to others, and that's always been a strong motivator for my work with Habitat. The camaraderie of being part of the team building side by side with the partner family is certainly hard to beat, and there's no doubt you get dirty in a good way during the process.
Sarah Franzen, how many Habitat for Humanity homes do we have in McLean County?
So we are currently sitting at 157 impacted families. So a large portion of those are new construction homes. A handful of those have also been revitalization projects. Or if we have a family that comes out of a current Habitat home, we will sometimes look at whether or not it makes sense to put another Habitat family into the home.
Habitat for Humanity homes are quite often thought of as being located in rundown areas of the community. To some extent, that's true because you can pick up a property at a cheaper price. But Habitat's also involved outside of Bloomington Normal. What communities do you work in here in McLean County, Sarah?
Yeah, you are correct. Most of our homes are built in the Bloomington Normal area just for a lot of different reasons. That's where most of our applicants come from. We also have done homes in Lexington, Hayworth, Saybrook, Gridley, and Shenoa. And while there's nothing official just yet, we are looking at some build opportunities out in Leroy in the near future, hopefully.
Have you been present when the keys are handed over on a Habitat home?
Yeah, I have. And that is probably, as a staff member, one of, I would say, the best parts of the entire process. You've seen the family from their application process all the way through. And there's something really powerful about being a part of that.
If I were to generalize and say tears and hugs were aplenty at that moment, would I be pretty close?
Absolutely. I've been on staff for about 3 years now, and so I've been to quite a few of the house blessing ceremonies, and I don't think we get through one without the tears and the hugs and a lot of thanking the community for their support. And again, the family just finds that, you know, it's hard for them to wrap their head around that strangers come in and build a home for their family, and it's incredible. Again, one of my favorite parts of the whole process.
Now let's segue into perhaps not one of your favorite parts of the whole process. Because you are the development director, that means basically you're the money person. Where does the money come from to keep Habitat running?
We have a lot of different ways that money comes into our affiliate. Some of those include individual donors, our corporate sponsors, local churches, fundraising events. We do hold our own mortgages, so that allows a continual stream to keep building and giving back to future families. Occasionally, we'll look into grant opportunities, but we really feel as a staff from a sustainability standpoint, and it's really best to concentrate on those we have more of a personal relationship with.
Stan, let's look forward here. I believe this is the 30th anniversary of our Habitat here.
That is correct, Jim.
Sarah said we had, I think, 157 homes in the county. So what will Habitat have accomplished 5 years from now?
Well, I think our future looks bright, Jim. We have tremendous support in the community. We would have expected 5 years from now to have partnered with over 30 more families to build simple, decent, affordable housing. We'd hope by then to have some new programming, A Brush with Kindness and Critical Repair, well-established, helping as many as perhaps 10 homeowners per year to maintain their investment in their homes. I think it's realistic to think that we will have built at least a couple of homes in one of the outlying communities, which we've not done in a number of years. We want to have a high level of community engagement and vibrancy in and around our West Washington Restore campus. One program we're working on is to establish an opportunity for members of our retired crew to teach woodworking skills to local high school students with the idea of building our own cabinets to put in houses.
You're also teaching maintenance skills to homeowners. Is it something that a lot of people of a younger generation don't have?
Oh, I would say that's true. And that's one of the real great advantages of volunteering with Habitat. I've done things at my own home I would have never attempted had I not had the experience of working with our retired crew.
You work on plumbing?
No, that's out of my league.
We're talking with Stan Giesen and Sarah Franzen of Habitat for Humanity. Their office at 103 West Jefferson, right on the square in downtown Bloomington. Correct me if I mess up here, Stan. The basic mission of Habitat, as I understand it, provide homes to needy families using donated skills along with the sweat of the future occupants. Pretty close?
Yeah, I'd say you're very close on those points. A couple of aspects of our programming I'd like to point out. We do use volunteer labor for the lion's share of the work under the direction of our construction manager. But there are tasks that we subcontract and let the professionals handle. The product we produce then is a quality structure that will stand up to the test of time. And then on the other side here, it is true that there's a financial need component in the qualification of partner families. However, we do not provide them with a home. They earn it. In addition to completing sweat equity in their own home, they partner on other families' homes, they work at our restore, and then they have to demonstrate the capability and follow through to pay off a 25-year zero-interest mortgage, which pays it forward and sustains our program for the future.
Out of all the different families that have moved into Habitat homes in McLean County, how many have been unable to meet their financial obligation on that?
So I think you're asking if we've had any foreclosures. It's my understanding we've only had one in the history of the affiliate. So that's a pretty good track record.
Stan Giesen, who along with Sarah Franzen is at the Habitat for Humanity's office building at 103 West Jefferson on the north side of the Courthouse Square.
That's GLT's Jim Brown. Tomorrow night, Habitat for Humanity of McLean County is holding a special event to say thanks to the community. It's called Rock the House. It begins at 6:30 at the Castle Theater. And Stan Giesen says he's excited about partnering with Heinz Lumber and the upcoming GLT Fund Drive with the Listen Pledge Build campaign.
Well, they're a supplier for pretty much many of our homes, I would say. What we're trying to do through the approach at the GLT Fund Drive is have people call in and make a pledge to GLT, and at the same time then Heinz will give 2x4s to Habitat. We'd like to get the lumber to build 3 homes next spring.
The GLT Listen Pledge Build campaign starts soon, but you can get a jump on things right now by contributing to support GLT programs at WGLT.org. You'll also be helping build Habitat for Humanity homes next spring. Again, that Habitat Rock the House event starts tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Castle Theater in Bloomington. Have you seen the new WGLT.org? You'll find even easier access to more content there, including your favorite Sound Ideas features curated in a handy tab on the homepage. Our website is also where you can send comments about what you hear during Sound Ideas, or you can send us an email. The address is news@wglt.org or post at facebook.com/WGLTFM. You can find the Sound Ideas podcast produced by Taylor Bauer at our website, including this episode with help from Laura Kennedy, Charlie Schlenker, and Jim Brown. I'm Willis Kern, and thanks too to former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood for stopping by today. And thanks to you for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Tune to GLT News and Ideas.